Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentons votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Stephanie Beck is one of Global Affairs' most prominent senior leaders. She and I joined the Foreign Service together almost three decades ago, and she was the envy of our class of young Foreign Service officers when she became a head of mission at the tender age of 34. She stopped by my office recently to talk about her journey in the Foreign Service, her life as a single mother, her decision to leave the department, and how she came back again less than a year ago.
Hey, Stephanie. Thanks for coming by my very high-tech A8 studio, which used to be my office. This is the very first episode of our new podcast called The GAC Files, so you should feel a very privileged guest. Just before we get into the interview, I want to remind you that this is a public forum and that both of us should refrain from discussing or disclosing any sensitive or classified information. Given we know each other quite well, I think I should also ask you to refrain from swearing. Those keen listeners will know that Stephanie usually speaks like a sailor. And also, consistent with Canada's Official Languages Act, I encourage you to speak in the language of your choice. So if you're set, why don't we just jump in? We're billing this as a podcast on the people, issues, and ideas of Global Affairs Canada. I'm quite interested in the people part, so I'm going to begin by sort of asking you where you came from. We know each other quite well, so, and for full disclosure for our listeners, Stephanie and I joined the department at roughly the same time, 1989-90. Stephanie was about 12 years old. But unlike the rest of us who came from exotic places like Lethbridge, Alberta, Stephanie had grown up all over the world, born in Guyana, high school in Singapore, kicked out of boarding school in Ontario.
Not so, quite kicked out, just suspended.
But tell us, you know, was it inevitable that you would end up in a place like Global Affairs or Foreign Affairs as it then was? Your siblings didn't. What made you do the international thing?
Mm-hmm. It's an excellent question. Mais tout d'abord, je veux commencer par dire que je suis honorée et privilégiée d'avoir été choisie pour être la première personne qui fait ce podcast. C'est d'une gentillesse. Et je veux juste souligner que je ne parle pas toujours comme un marinier. ça dépend, c'est qui l'audience et quand ce sont des amis peut-être. But I can get through a conversation without saying anything rude to some people's amazement. So my parents are New Zealanders, and they brought me up, I guess, in the same way they brought up. They were born and raised in New Zealand, a first generation in New Zealand. Their parents came from Scotland and Ireland, in fact. My mother was a Kennedy. And me and two of my brothers were born in British Guyana, upcountry in Mackenzie, in a bauxite mine because my father worked for Alcan. So I lived in bauxite mines all around the world, which were fascinating and great fun to play in, although my mother didn't like it much because your clothes are orange after you've played in bauxite mines. But you get to play in the big trucks and the big wheels and fish and do all kinds of things like slide down wet bauxite hills. Very entertaining. But it meant that I went to school in Guyana, in Jamaica, in the Saguenay Valley, in Singapore, and then back into the aforesaid boarding school, which will remain unnamed, in southern Ontario. But I grew up then with kids who came from all around the planet, who were of different nationalities, came from different backgrounds, different languages. And what struck me after moving to Canada was how I never actually noticed that. For me, their names were Kim or Nabil or Susan or Karen, but it was irrelevant. I was colorblind and background blind and whatever you might call it. So I discovered I really like that, and I like people, and I wanted a job then that meant I could do that all the time and even get paid for it.
What would you have done if you hadn't joined the department?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I first wrote the exam when I was at McGill, and I was also writing LSATs. So I guess more education would have been a possibility. And then after university, my dad went to work in Guinea, and again, upcountry, not in Conakry, in the capital city. So I graduated from McGill, actually went to work in Germany for a few months as a Buffet-Mädchen on an exchange in Friedrichshafen in southern Germany. And my dad called and said, do you want to come and live with me in Guinea? My mom wasn't going to go for another year. My little brother was in school. And geez, like, look for a job in Montreal or go live in the jungles of West Africa? Well, like, obviously. And I guess in retrospect, that wouldn't have been everybody's decision.
Right.
But for me, of course. And while I was there, I wrote the exam. And I did for the FS in the olden days.
Did you have to go to...
To London.
To London. Yeah.
And actually, I met some...
That's where I wrote it as well.
Yeah. Right. And I it was great. And when you write it and you're already abroad and living it, as the doctor who was doing my medical said, well, the proof is in the pudding. Like, obviously, you can do this because you do it.
So, and you enjoyed success early on in your career. You became a very young ambassador. But your first posting was... if I recall, to Senegal. And I don't recall anything else about your posting other than that you learned to fly.
Mm-hmm.
You got your pilot's license.
Mm-hmm.
What was that about?
It was people often ask, what's your favorite posting? I'm sure you've had that question too. You know, and it so much depends on who you are at that time of your life. So when I went to Senegal, it wasn't my first choice, by the way, all of you wondering about your postings. I wanted to go to Hong Kong. But anyways, it ended up being Dakar, and we covered Guinea. So I actually went back.
For the record, I wanted Argentina.
See?
And they sent a vegetarian.
I think I know who that was, too. But so I ended up back in a region that I actually knew a little bit about, and we covered Guinea. So I ended up going back as a diplomat to this place I had lived in for a year and a half. But in Dakar then, it was this great thing where we had Wednesday afternoons off and Friday afternoons off, that flexible work hours. And if I could respectfully ask the associate deputy minister, be pretty cool to do that in Ottawa. Peut-être juste pour l'été, mais au moins de temps en temps faire ça. Anyway, so I was richer at the time, being not married and no children. And, you know, who doesn't want to learn to fly? So there was a little flying school.
Didn't you also cover Mauritania or something like that?
Yes, we had seven countries of accreditation. So Cape Verde Islands, where I went to, of course, too. I think there are more Cape Verdeans who live. No, not to there. We flew to Mauritania. I got the High Commissioner to come up with me in a small plane. I wasn't flying that one. The poor man was green the whole way. It was a little bumpy. And I was sitting, we put him in the back because he was used to sitting in the back, of course. And he got a little hot. And by the time we landed in Nouakchott, he was looking a little uncomfortable. He didn't want to do it again. And I had to talk him into flying home, right? Because you can't just go one way in the small plane.
So I can't remember all the places, but Canberra was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Canberra, and then ambassador in Cambodia, and then ambassador in Croatia.
Cross-posted from Cambodia. So... how old were you when you became ambassador in Cambodia?
So I was 34, and I think at the time I was the youngest female ambassador.
Right.
And I think now there have been more younger women, but at the time it was... And HR told me at the time that they'd taken a risk. and I guess, but in some ways, you know, being out there by yourself, you actually become more cautious. And I don't normally think of myself as a particularly cautious person, but when you don't have a lot else to rely on, I found myself slowing down a little and not second guessing myself, but thinking through things more carefully before leaping to judgment.
What was the hardest thing? What challenges do you think you encountered because you were a 34-year-old woman?
Well, I think it also doesn't help that I'm not very tall. You guys can't see me on the podcast, but and I have freckles, and you know, I don't look very old. I think there are 34-year-olds who look a lot older than they are. But I have to say, I did have some fun with it. So this is not sensitive or classified information.
And
but
you're not going to swear.
No. So I went to meet the dean of the diplomatic corps, who happened to be an extremely old gentleman. And he said to me at least three times, mais vous êtes très jeune. Mais vous êtes très jeune, madame. Mais vraiment, vous êtes jeune. Est-ce que vous connaissez le premier ministre? As if I was a political appointee. And I said, mais non, en fait, c'est juste parce que je suis très intelligente. Like, what are you going to answer, right? And I couldn't say, well, you look really old, because I'm politer than that. But after that, he just, you know, accepted me at my word. But there was another one where I was at a diplomatic event at a reception, and another ambassador from a foreign country, like, leaned in and stared at me and said the same thing. You're very young. You're very, gosh, goodness, you know. And I got a little tired of this because it's been about the 20th time. So I leaned over and whispered into his ear, actually, I'm a lot older than I look, but I've had plastic surgery. So, I couldn't resist. It's not true, by the way, but I couldn't resist.
What advice would, I mean, you know the challenges you faced, and they can't have all been fun. What advice would you give to women that are young or women that mm-hmm. look young that, you know, are not taken as seriously as maybe they should be? You diffused it with humor sometimes, but what advice would you have?
Well, I think one of the benefits of going in with the title ambassador right. and being the representative of Canada means you have kind of a 5-10 minute delay. You have a by default, they're going to take you seriously and you will have respect. So you need to use that time to demonstrate that you're worthy of that respect, that you will be delivering, that you know your files, that you know why you're there. And once you get over that initial, then the rest of the meeting goes well. The other thing I would say is using it to your advantage in that they will remember you. There is no one else there who is that young or looks like that or who represents that country. So you have an automatic memory jogger that not every country sure. has. Yeah. So that
turn
I found very useful.
Turn it to your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So after Cambodia and Croatia, you came back to Ottawa as a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
Your kids were...
were quite young, 6 and 3 at the time.
How was that?
So remember around that time, it was when we were starting to get BlackBerries and other mobile tools
right.
and you can work from home. So in the beginning, what I did, and actually not that different from you, David, being a single dad, is have a huge network and lots of a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, live-in caregivers, babysitters, friends. My parents don't live in Ottawa. The children's father actually moved to Madagascar, so he wasn't nearby for weekends or anything. Couldn't really call upon him. I did, though, occasionally call on my former mother-in-law, and she would come from time to time, which is good. She's particularly good at organizing the pantry, and of course, she loved the children, so that was great. But I was a little worried, or actually, maybe I shouldn't say that. I wasn't so much worried, but others were worried about how I would be able to do my job. Wouldn't I be
yeah.
distracted, and wouldn't I need to go home early, and how would this all play out? And it didn't actually work out like that, because I was in the beginning director of defense and security relations, which was a big job, Afghanistan, NATO detainee, NATO and Afghanistan with the detainees. And then the second year in the minister's office with Minister Bernier. And indeed in that job, the then chief of staff asked me, well, you're a single mom. Are you going to be able to do this job? And I thought, would you have asked that of a single dad? But in fact, what I found was in both of those positions, because I had the flexibility to work from home, or actually I should put it like I could leave at 5:30 or 6 in the minister's office sometimes later, but I had the Berry
yeah.
and I could go and I could be bathing the child and occasionally checking the BlackBerry. And particularly in the minister's office, I wasn't writing the briefs. I was writing to say, emergency, can you deal with it? So there are ways of managing.
Did that experience make you more organized, more able to, oui. to focus on what's important?
Peut-être c'est un peu des deux. J'ai ouais. toujours été très organisée. Maman me l'a dit quand j'avais 3 ans, 4 ans, c'est toi qui organisais les fêtes, c'est ouais. toi qui dirigeais ouais. les gens à l'école. But for sure, multitasker, thinking 5 different chess moves ahead, what am I going to need to do to set this up? Major long-term planning. And yeah, it makes you more efficient at your job too, because you've thought through all of the different, usually bad things that can happen. If you think worst case scenario.
In my own experience, and you taught me this, the government is a very family friendly employer. For those of you who don't know, if you're a single parent, the government will pay a babysitter to stay overnight when you have to travel for business. So that's a tip from me via me from Stephanie, because it is, I've personally worked in a number of different institutions in different countries, and there's no place I've ever seen where that is more accommodating of the demands of single parents, but of families in general. So mm-hmm. that's a plug for mm-hmm. public service career. Let's go on, Stephanie, to another thing that I think distinguishes you and your trajectory. When I came back to the department, or to Canada in 2012, 2013, you were a DG in, or maybe acting ADM in platform mm-hmm. branch. So you have done the minister's office, done the geographic, done
multilateral, the multilateral, bilateral,
as well as corporate services. And then to the surprise of many of us, you left the department definitively, mm-hmm. right? Quit.
Yep.
Global Affairs, as it probably then was, and joined IRCC as the ADM
corporate.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that experience.
Mm-hmm. So I get, first of all, just to switch into to corporate, into that part of it. So I had been a political officer and then an EX manager by then for, gosh, it must have been 19 years, something like that. And the election was called when I was in the minister's office. By then it was Minister Emerson. And I was looking around for what else do I want to do next? And you have that. Okay, I've been there. I've done that. I've done this other thing. And I thought, I really want to know how corporate works. Like, where does the money come from? It doesn't fall off trees, weirdly. It does seem to appear when you need it, but maybe not always in the shape that we'd like it to be. The people, how do we manage our people? What is performance management? What is a staffing action? So I thought if I went and did corporate for a while, I'd get a better insight into the skeleton of the department. Yeah. And I thought it would be useful for any future job. And frankly, I really like managing lots of people and lots of money. So hence then the foray into corporate services here initially in the department in platform and then over to IRCC. And that was a long, hard thinking decision. So by then, I'd been in nearly a quarter of a century, imagine that, in this department. And I kind of thought, well, what else do I want to do here? And I'd been on posting by then 4 times.
And you said you don't want to be home anymore.
No, not, but you know, lived most of my life abroad. Right. And now I know I'd have to do the math to check, but at the time I'd certainly lived most of my life abroad. I didn't really feel like moving again and uprooting the children, and they were in good places too. And I thought I want to go see what else happens in the government right. of Canada. And I loved being at Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, a fantastic department. And this is a plug, great mandate, really clear on what we're yeah. supposed to do all day long, a slightly smaller organization, but still 8,000 people.
Yeah, and a presence abroad, and yeah. and you lived and survived the Syria refugee crisis.
Operation, that was fabulous, yeah. and it was really great to be part of that exercise as well. Good timing.
What new perspective do you have on this place? Because you really cut the cord and went elsewhere. What mm-hmm. what would you tell people about global affairs that those that work here might not know?
Mm-hmm. You know, what really struck me in the initial few weeks and months was the physical isolation of this building, which you don't notice when you're in here. And especially when I was in platform, I thought, man, I know what's going on all around town. I've got 34 clients. I talk to them all the time. But once you get downtown, and the IRCC office was at the corner of Laurier and Kent,
restaurants.
You don't have time to get to them then either. But it's the physical space that I hadn't realized how much that that mental shift is that you're actually part of the government of Canada. You're not on this little island offshoot off to the side. And I got a much better understanding of what the domestic priorities are and then how those play into the international priorities and how we can't do foreign policy without thinking about what's happening in Canada.
Mais enfin, tu as décidé de revenir.
Mais le timing marchait. C'est, ouais. C'est toujours une question de timing, hein, je trouve, quand on change de position. Qu'est-ce qui a ouvert, à quel moment? Je voulais changer de position de toutes les façons. Ça faisait 3 ans et demi que j'étais à IRCC, ouais. que ouais. j'ai adoré. Mais j'étais dans un concours de promotion. J'avais réussi. C'était le moment de où est-ce que je vais maintenant? And timing worked out. The Global Affairs was looking for people who had a bit of a mix of experience, who had been on posting, who knew what that life was like. And I must say, for this particular job as the ADM of Europe, Middle East, Maghreb, and the Arctic, running 50-plus missions in 70-plus countries, knowing corporate services makes a huge yeah. difference.
So tell, how does it happen? You're out there at another department.
Mm-hmm.
Timing is important, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to this question. The phone rings and it's Ian Shugart. How did you come back?
So actually, it's always fun to find. It's like birthing stories for the mothers around you. So how did your baby? But actually, I went to a party. That's how these things happen. So over the years, I of course maintain close contact with friends and colleagues at Global Affairs. And the usual posting season was coming about. I had been looking at a position actually in the United Nations. So I'd had the assistance of Global Affairs colleagues for that, which didn't work out, which was kind of a bummer because I saw the package. Man, you get a lot of money if you get, just also a plug, if you get one of those UN jobs, amazing. Not the same as Government of Canada. Anyway, so I went to this reception actually at the British High Commission. And I was wandering around and I bumped into one of the directors general who said, so I hear you're coming back. And I was all surprised. Like, what? I thought, does he know I'm moving at IRCC? Because that was the plan. I was going to switch jobs. And I kind of, with a non-answer. And then I bumped into another of the deputy ministers of this department who said, Stephanie, you should really come back and have a conversation. We have some openings and you should really. Right. And I said, oh, right. Well, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. And then like another 10 minutes passes and another deputy minister, there are a lot of deputy ministers in global affairs, comes up to me and says, Stephanie, you really need to come and have a conversation. We have some openings we should really discuss. So I said, well, thank you, Josh. Geez, very nice. And eventually I wrote to Ian and I said, it has been suggested that I come and have a conversation. And he was the nicest man, I have to say. He said, I wrote on a Saturday and he wrote back and he said, yeah, let's come over. And he said, it was so nice. He said, would Tuesday be all right with you?
Yeah.
And would you mind coming to my office? And I did hesitate for a moment. Should I say no? You must come to my office. But I just, and it was also that respect that reminded me of what a great place this is. And I'd like to work for a deputy who is gracious and respectful.
So, I mean, in my experience, that's often how you stumble into jobs, right? It's timing and luck and those things. But I do recall when you came back and used colorful language to describe just how many countries you were in charge of, and you didn't know how you would ever keep them all straight, and so on. I say this as a former head of the Americas branch. It's a huge operation with, I think, the biggest footprint in terms of missions and heads of mission and all that implies in terms of managerial responsibility and PMAs and all the rest of that. Let me switch a little bit again, and we can have you back on the pod to talk about all that's going on in the Middle East and Europe and so on. But before we run out of time, I do, in the era of Me Too and how our department's trying to come to terms with that, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you what it's been like. You must have been in almost 30 years now, so joining at a very different time. Speak to your trajectory as being a woman at Global mm-hmm. Affairs, and any advice you would give to other women, particularly young women.
Mm-hmm. It's not as easy as you might think. I don't mean the trajectory. I mean the giving the advice part, because I think, like most people, not just women, we just come to work and do our best and hope that it takes us to interesting places. And in my career, I didn't ever particularly think I'm not getting a job or a position or something because I'm a woman. I guess if anything, it would have been more because I'm young and I look inexperienced or, you know, something like that, but not specifically female related. And in retrospect, in my old age, since apparently we're now senior management, which I always think is funny, so I don't think of myself as a senior, is I look back and think, what was it that I was doing or the position that I was in that meant that I was able to progress and to move to another one? And often it is timing, but often it is just sheer diligence. And I guess the other thing I would say is choosing a job you like. It's better to do a job that you're really interested in and to do it well than to choose a job because you think it's going to
advance you or...
Right. Then you're kind of faking it, and that's always visible.
I mean, I think personally that authenticity is amongst the most compelling traits a person can have. And it's easy to see in my experience as a manager, somebody who does spend all of their time pre-positioning for the next job as opposed to just really loving the job that they're doing at that time. Mm-hmm. Another thing that is, I think, super important for people on the way up is choosing who they want to work for.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about training, but in fact, most people learn from observing others, not mm-hmm. from formal training courses. So it's choosing your boss.
And I would say learning in both directions, learning what is not good in the behavior of a senior manager and what is good. Because, you know, you like things about your boss, you don't like things about your boss. And being able to say, gosh, I'm never going to do that, is just as valuable as, gee, that is an excellent practice and I want to follow that. I guess the other thing I'd say is that there weren't, and maybe more now, but there certainly, while I was growing up in this department, not a whole lot of senior women. So in terms of mentors or people you'd want to be like, we'd often have to cast the net pretty broadly. So, you know, would be the likes of Marie-Lucie Morin or Catherine McCallion, who would be saying, you know, Colleen Swords. Yeah. These would be names that probably the young uns out there wouldn't recognize. But these were women who were ahead of their time and as leaders in the department and demonstrating the kinds of values and behaviors that, you know, I want to be like her when I grow up, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So now, as a leader, that's what I try and portray. I want to be the kind of leader that I would like to work for, if that makes sense. You know, do unto others sort of mantra. Yeah. And to be very aware of the impact of what we say and do has on our staff, and particularly on our women. And I try to be aware of that. It's not always easy. Sometimes you're just doing the job.
Yeah, but Stephanie and I went on the same leadership course, sort of an EX4-5 leadership course all last year. And that was kind of one of the key lessons, is that you are leading even when you don't think you are, because people are watching. I always find it strange in my new role when somebody comes in and the first thing they do is apologize for taking up my time, when actually my job is to see people and get to know them and mm-hmm. Try to provide them with advice or try to help solve their problems. I think that's part of what it means to be a senior leader in the kind of organization that we both work at.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree that's most of what I do, is looking after people so that they can do their jobs.
Well, that's great. Merci, Stephanie. This has been, I think, a great first episode. And we'll have to have you back to mm-hmm. talk more about your policy files.
Merci beaucoup. I look forward to it.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des Dossiers d'AMC.